This is Bob Nguyen from Bad Influence Tattoo. Almost 30 years in the game now.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over.
I heard about you from several of my family members who are tattoo artists, and they said, Bob is the guy that you really want to talk to if you want to get to know the old school tattoo and even cultural cultural viewpoint of the Vietnamese 30, 40 years ago in Orange County. So here we are.
Oh, how's it going? Good morning to you.
Good morning. Good morning. So where did your family come when they arrived in America?
So we were boat people, refugees, 79. My mom took us and left Vietnam in 79, four of us. And we were sponsored by a church group in Arizona to come over to America. So we arrived in Arizona. We stayed there for about a month and then moved to Utah with my uncle and stayed in Utah for about 5 years and gradually moved our way out to California to be with the rest of my mom's family to California, Orange County in particular.
How old were you when you got to OC?
I was about 15 years old.
Got to high school in Orange County.
Yeah, pretty much. It was like a freshman, I believe, in Orange County. And then just kind of like gradually, adapted to the California lifestyle, which was a big culture shock coming from like a pretty much all white high school into an integrated mixed culture high school was kind of weird, but it was eye opening in that you get to be around your culture now, and so I was considered whitewashed pretty much.
I'm just gonna bring that up because a lot people who are coming from Utah or Arizona, Mississippi, they're coming from these places and then they go to Orange County to go to high school. And they're around a lot more Mexicans, Vietnamese, and it's a totally different shift in how we're kind of thinking about our culture at the time.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't really aware of my culture, just coming from Vietnam, leaving that culture, and then at 9 years old, having to adapt to the Western culture. I mean, as kids, I think we adapt a lot quicker. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like we'll just kind of soak up whatever is around us a lot quicker and kind of just assimilate ourselves into that culture quicker. And that's what I did. I mean, I grew up listening to like country music, rap music, rock music was a big influence. So I had a lot of like just Western culture, like just not force fed, but just consume me pretty much. So when I came over, I had to readapt and learn how to speak Vietnamese again and like fluent Vietnamese again. And that was a shock too.
When I've hung out with you a few times, I didn't know that you were coming from, these other states. And I was like, there's something different about Bob. You know, he's not like the typical, guy my age who grew up in Orange County. There's like this very whitewashed identity from the early days. I could feel it. And I was we'll talk about that on the podcast. So here we are.
I think a lot of us that have that kind of background, we recognize that. We'll pick that up right away.
Right away.
Just from like maybe the first few sentences, and the way we talk, I guess, and I'm not trying to put out now our culture or the way Vietnamese people speak English around here, but you can definitely tell because I had like still homies that have been here longer than I have, and they still have that Vietnamese, that kind of accent. And it's just because we're just around, we're in our little bubble here in Orange County, So it's like one accent influencing another. So you just never grow out of that accent, I guess. Yeah. But I can pick that up. I can pick that up from you too. Like You definitely have like a more of a Western influence growing up, probably too, right?
Yeah, I grew up not around a whole lot of Vietnamese people my first, you know, 25 years.
There you go.
But I always was in the community, but I didn't, you know, I wasn't living in Orange County. I lived in LA, and so it was just you know, it's so stupid because I used to be very proud of that. I used to be very proud of the fact that I was cut off from my culture because of the intense amount of shame of living outside of it. Then you become proud of this like weird,
I
I'm
know.
not
Like,
them. I'm not
yeah,
like
I'm better. I'm better
I'm
than
better
most of
than
them
them.
type of. I see a lot of that too, and I get it. You know what I mean? I get it because we're, I guess, I don't know. We're just taught, you know, from TV or whatever, even our own people, you know.
Definitely, definitely.
Yeah, shame us for not being like more westernized, you know.
Yeah. And I'm repulsed about that part of me today.
Oh
When I think back about it, I'm like,
for
oh,
sure.
it's really cringy and hurtful, you know? And so whenever I hear any guys my age or a little bit older who are from another place and they talk down on big enclaves of Vietnamese people, I really take the time to really, okay, let me explain. Juneteenth was yesterday, and I was hanging out with some Asian American people, and they were like, what is the point of all this? And so I had to kind of break it down and like
The point of
explain
all what?
why we have Juneteenth.
Oh, okay.
You know what, why does the African American groups have their own day, and why doesn't the Asian Americans have our day? And
Why
so
do what you what, who cares? Why would you even ask that? That's silly to me. Like,
because
who cares?
if you're racist,
You
you
care.
care.
Because it should be white day every day. That's what they're saying. All lives matter.
All lives matter. Yeah, that's what it
Yeah,
is. It's crazy. Well, glad
it's,
we're talking the same language, Bob. But again, I'm not closed off to people who are like that, because they're, you know, it was a 52, 53-year-old Japanese American that I was talking to last night complaining about Juneteenth. And then I start to break down the different immigration patterns of the Vietnamese, the Japanese, the Hawaiians. And if you break it all down and then you compare it against the black community, and then he was like, oh my God, I had no idea the privilege that we in the Asian American community have, especially the Vietnamese. You know, 1975, 130,000 of the elite members of the South government left Vietnam. And if we go deeper into 1954 and talk about like the French, you know,
Colonization and all that.
it's complex. But you realize like all the offspring of the people that came in 1975, 1979, all of that first wave, it comes from people who are hungry, who are educated, they got to America, they had an opportunity, and they just kicked ass. And so you can't compare it against 400 years of, you know, oppression of blacks and systemic.
I don't think they had a choice.
Yes.
It was like, hey, want to go on a cruise?
Yeah.
You know what
Yeah.
I mean?
Yeah, it's
So
brutal, man.
we wanted to be here, you
Yeah,
know. So
exactly.
I think that's what it is. It's like for us, being here is we're grateful already,
Yeah.
you know, because we wanted to be here. We did what I mean. My mom like just scooped all of us up and just escaped in the middle of the night. And you know, and paid her dues, got on the boat, get robbed, and all that stuff. We wanted to be here. So for us, whatever scraps we were given, we're like, oh, thank you, you know. And I think that's probably why. And same with maybe that Japanese gentleman you're talking about, you know, like their family wanted to be here, even though they, you know, they were mistreated, you know, really horribly in
Yeah.
those encampments back in what, like in the 40s,
Right
the
after the
50s and
war. Yeah.
stuff. Yeah, and so. Even with all that, they're like, dude, we're just happy to be here.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I can't say that another culture should be grateful at the same time, you know, because they were brought here under different circumstances,
Right. Right.
right? So yeah, so I'm not gonna speak for anybody, but let people have their day, man. Who cares?
Yeah.
There's plenty of days. There's like
And I
365 days.
Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
And I told my brother, I go, brother, look, do you want a day? Work yeah. If you want a day, if you want to like set up a day for us, like, okay, yeah. Let's break this down. How would you get, pick a day? Pick a day yeah. and pick a reason and let's work with this. Let's work through this exercise.
Yeah.
There was no answer. It was like, I was like, there's too many different types of Asians. All right. That's the first problem, right? You can't get like one Asian day because there's like so many different types of Asian. And then, all right, even if you can figure out one Asian day, what would that be?
Yeah.
Right? Like, let's pick an Asian day, but pick out the reason why we should have an Asian day.
Yeah, exactly. What is what makes this day so particularly like special for all the Asians? Like, can we all the Asians sit down and pick out a day? I don't think we can.
No, it's not like the day where the last day of freedom, a last day of slavery, and everybody's free. That's like a thing. And you know, anyway, after that, it was like, There really is nothing to kind of like put your hat on, you know, and then like in San Jose, there's like Ao Yai Day that they've, you know, that they've legislated in the San Jose sort of like government.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
It's great. Yeah. You know? It's community doing their thing. And I love that part of that specific niche. But that, you know, anyway, I'm getting into the weeds. I want to hear about your experience in the late 80s going into the 90s about sort of men of your age and what you experienced, because I think there was a real big insurgence of like gangs and street life and unhappy young men that were coming from Vietnam, probably your age, that didn't have families. I don't know if you lived through that. I don't know if you were sheltered and protected from that, but
I kind of touched on it a little bit. Like I said, I came over in the mid 80s. So right away, I was kind of introduced to a little bit of like the gang life.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, I'm inherently a bad kid, you know, to begin with, you know, growing up without a dad. My dad was, you know, still in Vietnam in the, you know, the re-education camp, they call it, you know, because he fought on the
south side.
On the south side. And so he was, you know, incarcerated after the war for about 10 years. So we actually left without him. So growing up without a father figure, and I was the only boy, I pretty much became the man of the house and the rent of the house. No, my mom, God bless her, tried so hard to, you know, discipline me and, you know, and if you're a young Vietnamese man growing up with all these influences, you know, going to school, you had to kind of like click up just because there were so many other culture that you were forced to click up in order to kind of protect yourself. And this is back in the 80s where, like, you know, I guess racial tension were really high amongst Asians and all the other communities. And in retrospect, I understand why now. It's because they were brought up to kind of like hate Vietnamese people because their, you know, fathers, uncles, cousin, or whatever fought in the war.
Yeah.
And some of them, many of them have lost their lives in the war. So growing up, it was almost like, and I hate to put this in this type of perspective, but kind of like 9/11, post 9/11, where a lot of people were just hating on anybody brown skin. And that has like a turban on or that speaks with like a Middle Eastern accent, you know what I mean? For like the longest time, probably 10 years or so.
Yeah.
Now just imagine that on a bigger scale, a lot more people have lost their lives, right? So there was a lot of like animosity.
It was still fresh.
Yeah, so fresh. So fresh. It's only like 10 years old.
Years, yeah.
Yeah, so fresh. And they were taught to hate us. We're like, you know, we were taught to even like defend ourselves no matter what situation we're in. So, and you know, so just growing up in that environment, you're kind of forced into it. And I was a bad kid already to begin with. I don't think I was evil or mean or malicious. I was just that kid just having fun and wanted to click up. I didn't have any brothers. So my street brothers were my brothers pretty much. So growing up, immediately introduced that gang lifestyle and, you know, got into trouble and kind of like, you know, did things not because we were poor. We were poor. Don't get me wrong. We weren't starving. You know, we were well fed. Granted, I slept in the living room, but it wasn't like we're sleeping, you know, in sheds or anything like that. So for me, it wasn't about going out there and hurting people and getting money and stuff like that. It was just trying to have fun and, you know, being that lifestyle. It's so easy to like get immersed in that gang culture because of the brotherhood and, you know, which is a lot of bullshit anyways. But, you know, that's another time.
I mean, if you think about what you just said about, oh, it's all bullshit, you know, I don't know if it's all bullshit because I think it was a necessity at the time because a lot of the men didn't have fathers, just like you. We're talking about the guidance was not there and the itch to, you know, if your mom is out working, your family's out working and you're like, you have no sort of like guidance.
Yeah.
You have to turn to other men of your age and a little older to kind of feel that familial bond, right?
Yeah.
It was a very necessary thing in the early 90s to click up because facing persecution on the streets and living lives, you know, a lot of the demographics that you're talking about.
So when I say bullshit, I don't mean it in like, I regret it, okay? Yeah. I mean the bullshit because then you learn later that it was when it started out was pure, you know, brotherhood, da da da. And then later on, you know, and later on in like the 90s and stuff, then it became like, for me anyways, and I think a lot of my brothers too back then, we kind of went that route too. It's almost like a
power dynamics.
Not power dynamics so much, it's like progression of a criminal lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know, you first start off by like, you know, stealing cars and stuff like that. And then, you know, you graduate into doing like burglaries, robberies. And then it was more into like the 90s, we were into more like white collar stuff, like, you know, credit card checks and so on and so forth. And then some people went so far as to go into drug dealing and stuff like that. So when it started out, it was a pure us clicking up, protecting each other, having fun and stuff like that. And then as that lifestyle, I guess, progressed into more criminal activity.
I see now.
That's where the bullshit began. When the money was introduced.
I
and
get
the
it.
Criminal lifestyle and the bullshit, then there was no more loyalty. Because, so then that's what I mean by bullshit.
God,
you know what I mean? So you're held together by a namesake, like a gang namesake.
Yeah.
And then later on, that went out the window when money was introduced.
Right.
You know, because now you're graduating to making like, instead of a couple hundred bucks off a car stereo, now you're making like tens of thousands on, you know, credit card checks and stuff like that. Then people started ratting each other out. People start like, I don't know, just, you know, breaking off into littler cliques and, you know, just stuff like that. And that's when the bullshit, you know, started happening. And I kind of recognized that and I kind of broke away from it. And a lot was attributed to me just having my daughter at a young age. I had her at 21 years old, and so, and just being, you know, fresh out of camp, if you know what I'm saying. I kind of just wanted a change of the lifestyle.
Yeah,
you know?
And
it was a long fought battle. It wasn't like an overnight thing. I just one day I started going to church and stuff like that.
Yeah,
it was like long fought battle and, you know, just getting out of that lifestyle. And then I found tattooing. So that's kind of was my savior.
When were you into this sort of like artistic expression in your early life? When was the first sign of it?
So just growing up, I always drew. You know, I drew, I doodle, and I draw anywhere I can, I guess, on my folder, my desk. Even in like high school and throughout school, I was exceptional, I guess, to where the teacher would just kind of let me draw my own project pretty much, you know, instead of like having me like sit and draw some apples and pears with some light source, yeah, I was beyond that. And so he or she, whichever teacher, would like, hey, just draw me something. And that's how, and I would just make up my own projects. And that's how I would just get through through school. I mean, every grade, I would get A's in art and C's and D's in all the other classes. Mm. You know what I mean? So I kind of knew, I had the ability, and I kind of knew that whatever I wanted to do in my life after that, it would have to be
art,
something to do with art, you know? And so just like picking up a tattoo machine back in the day was like a natural thing. It's like, you have the Vietnamese culture where you put out, what is it, a scissor, a pen, that's a baby. And then I think a tool or something.
The Korean culture?
No, the Vietnamese culture.
I didn't know the Vietnamese did.
Yeah. So we have babies. We'll put baby on the floor, and then we'll set up these items, you know, and like a pen, a spoon.
I've never heard this before.
You know, no, you ask your parents, or ask any older Vietnamese.
Because I know the Koreans do that. It's probably from the Chinese culture, probably.
Maybe.
Koreans have this, like, it's like a year in, they number whatever, and they do it.
Yeah. Yeah, they set that up, and then I don't know, the younger generation don't do it as much, but I think we did it for my daughter, and I think she gravitated towards the pen, so that's why she's a tattoo artist today.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, she works at my shop, and Chris and Andy is interviewing her tonight at my shop. For a podcast.
How fun.
As like, I guess, a byproduct of a Vietnamese tattoo dad.
Yeah, we should definitely get her on. I'd love to hear
her. You should. She's awesome. She's 32. She's killing it in the game.
And she's your firstborn? The one that
she's my firstborn.
Yeah.
So anyways, like I said, you know, like how they set these tools or objects up, and the baby would crawl towards whichever ones they gravitate, and it kind of would indicate what they would choose in life, I guess, later on. Yeah. But so for me, that was like me just gravitating towards art no matter what. Even as a teenager, I used to like, make tattoo machines and tattoo my homies and stuff like that. And just had fun doing that, you know, and it just came so natural to me just to do stuff like that. And I'm not an artist, and I'm not refined as an artist. You know, I just know I have this talent. So it just comes out naturally, but I'm not by any means like some great artistic person. I don't think I'm very artistic at all. You know what I mean?
Let's define, what does it mean to you to be artistic? Like, when you say that means, is it a craft that you feel like you haven't perfected yet? Or what is it that you are saying? I mean, you've been in business for 30 something years. How could you say you're not artistic? I would love to hear what you think.
So because I see my peers, I see like some of my peers and they live and breathe the art. You know, they draw, they paint, they do stuff. Like, and my buddy, Paul Nguyen, who owns 11 Door Studio, he's a phenomenal artist, tattoo artist. And he's still out there doing murals, and he still paints, and he drew this crazy Tibetan skull that he gifted me after he tattooed me. And I'm like, you still draw, bro? You still do all this? Like, yeah, man, I still do all that stuff. And when people ask me, do I still draw when I'm off work and paint? I'm like, I never painted a day before my whole life, and I'm not about to do now, because, you know, I'm consumed by art every day when I go to work. The last thing I do is I want to take my work home with me. You see what I'm saying? So for me, I don't think I'm an artist. I just think I'm a natural artist in that I was born with it. And for me, it's just a part of my life and work. So I guess I would, I classify myself a little under what Paul is. You know what I mean? Paul is an artist. He's a true artist. He does that. So maybe I'm just humbling myself by saying that, but I don't live and breathe art. Tattoo. I don't live and breathe art. You know what I mean? I just feel like I was gifted with that. So I'm going to use it to make a living, to, you know, provide for my family. I'm grateful for it. Don't get me wrong. But there's so much artistry out there that deserves more attention. You know, when you're saying the word artist, you get what I'm saying?
Yeah. I love your humility. I do understand what you're talking about. You don't find the need to live and breathe an artist's life.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to be the starving artist sitting in a cellar or an attic somewhere with paint all over my face drinking wine. And, you know, so that's, I guess, to me, that's what I think an artist is. A true artist is just somebody who just is immersed in that intensity of creativity. You know what I mean?
Why do you think clients come to you?
But my winning personality, bro, you know,
I mean, I don't know. I mean, years.
Yeah. I mean, I guess half of it has to be my personality because I duly truly think that the tattoo art is 50-50, because you're face to face. Sometimes you're like right here next to a person for hours at a time, sharing this little space, you know, it's very personal. And you kind of feed off each other's vibe too, you know? So you kind of have to be friendly and you have to be receptive. And you have to learn how to, you know, carry a conversation, obviously. And along with that, you have to be good at what you're doing. So I think it's 50-50. To be successful in that, to have consistent work, you know? Success to me, that's what success is. Just having consistent work, not necessarily making the big bucks, because I know a lot of tattoo artists that make big bucks and I don't think I'm there. I think I just do it. I think I'm building relationships and it makes it more fun for me.
Yeah,
you know, to build relationship too, in that, you know, because you got to be with that person 4 or 5 hours at a time. And most of my clients are repeat clients that I see like throughout the whole year until we finish a project, which is like a whole leg or whole back, whole arm. And then they'll take a break and they'll come back and they'll do the other leg later on. And so you're like with them for hours and hours, 30 to 50 hours per project, you know, and 10 sessions or so. Yeah.
I hear this with Dizzy and with Andy, you know, both have said that it's like, almost like a therapist. You are.
Yeah. Yeah. And it goes both ways. Don't get me wrong. Cause once you build up a relationship to where you're open enough with a client, then you start to share and you start to share without even knowing that you're sharing. Cause you were like, oh man, I just had a horrible day, bro. You know, I had a flat tire and then I pulled over, and you find yourself, you know, divulging information, and they're receiving it. They're like, oh man, that sucks, bro. Yeah. Oh man. And so it just comes natural to me anyways, you know? And so that's probably why I still have like a nice, you know, reliable clientele list. You know?
And I probably suspect a lot of nail techs out in the world, in the Vietnamese community, good ones probably are talented in what they do, but more importantly, they're really good at connecting with
relationships. For sure, for sure. And I don't know what it is about sitting in that chair.
Yeah.
Where people feel like they gotta just open up. Like, yeah, they're talking about like super personal stuff that they don't even tell their kids and their spouse, you know, and they're like, and they know, for me, they know that it stays with me.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. I might laugh about it. And you know, I might be bulging with my wife and stuff like that. Like, oh man, this client's telling me this, but it doesn't go out of that. You know, it just, yeah, I got to share with somebody too, but I don't necessarily go out and broadcast it too. But I don't like, you know, as soon as they turn their back, I'll be like, hey, to the whole shop, this guy has a freaking growth out of his butt, blah, 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 you know?
So
they know that. They know that it's, you know, it stays with me, you know, and I think that's probably why they just feel like they can just, you know.
I think something that's, you know, my guess is like when you're getting ink and you're getting this needle in you and it's so painful mm-hmm. that I think along with that purging process, people can divulge information and let it out simultaneously, right? It's a sort of a one-stop shop for somebody's
yeah.
pain.
Yeah, it's a lot of, what do you call it? It's a little bit therapeutic too, because, and just speaking from my own personal experience, I had a few years back, I had a really bad emotional, like a breakup, you know? And so I spent like once a week, I was getting tattooed for 4 or 5 hours at a time.
Oh, yeah.
And just trying to, you know, fill in all these gaps that I had on my arm and stuff. So, and I wasn't divulging one bit of information about what was going on in my life. I just kind of soaked that pain in. And for some reason, it was therapeutic for me. And I understood why people, you know, think it's, because I hear people all the time, oh man, this feels good. This feels good. I'm like, you're crazy, man. This hurts like hell, you know?
Right.
I still think it hurts, you know? And from that day on, I understood, you know, and it was like 15 years into my career already. I finally understood, like, because for me, it wasn't about just the pain. It was like about doing something so primal and selfish for yourself. You know, you're paying money. You're getting this personal art for yourself, on yourself, that belongs to nobody. Nobody can take that from you.
Yeah.
Go to the grave with it. So it's about that personal satisfaction of doing something for yourself that was therapeutic too. You know what I'm saying?
I do.
Yeah. Like people who go out and work out, right? They push weight and stuff like that. It's like, oh, that's therapy. Yeah, because you're doing something good for yourself. You know, only you can do that for yourself.
Yep. This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients, wild-caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam, and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tung Phat.
Yeah.
When it comes to Vietnamese art and working in tattooing over the last few decades, have you seen Vietnamese art growing more and more, or has it always kind of been there for you?
Vietnamese art in particular, I don't think we have a particular style of art. We, I think, kind of adapted a lot of different artistry from like other culture, I think, mainly like Japanese and Chinese influence. As far as tattoo anyways. Yeah, we have like dragons and stuff like that. But the dragons we adapted were from like paintings or anything that from other Vietnamese artists. We kind of adapt that. And then we adapt like Chinese art into it. And so for me, the Vietnamese art, I don't see like an original art form. You know what I mean? So when you ask me, has Vietnamese art progressed or anything like that? It's just, I think we just took a little bit from everybody and kind of made it our own.
Yeah.
Right. Even in the tattoo world, like if you see guys with like tattoos of dragons and women and koi fish and stuff like that, back in the day, it was more like the prison style.
Yeah.
You know, so we took a lot of that from like Chinese art and then integrated into like a prison art style, like collage and stuff like that. So, I mean, growing up, that's what I saw. I saw prison art, mostly, like I said, dragons and women and koi fishes and tigers and stuff like that. So when you ask me Vietnamese art, that's the only thing I have to kind of reference back to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that prison lifestyle, that prison artwork and drawing big murals, and which I used to draw like big murals for, you know, homies and stuff like that. And so when I see other artists now coming up, like, I see them. They're more modern. They're very Western influence, like a lot of abstract art. So I really don't know where the progression of the Vietnamese art is, other than just what I'm surrounded by. You know, mostly like contemporary art, I guess. You know,
I love your answers. They're so honest and so like straight. You know, it's refreshing.
yeah, I don't know how else to speak.
Yeah, it's just straight up like, well, I don't know about the Vietnamese.
I have a checks and balance in my head. It's like, don't bullshit. That's bullshit. No bullshit. That's bullshit.
Yeah.
So and I try to stay on the no bullshit side a lot.
When you look at a tattoo, do you ever think like, what makes a good tattoo? What makes a bad tattoo?
Oh man, anybody can tell that. You know, like you don't have to be an artist. You know, right away you see something crappy, you're like, ooh. You know, you just judge by people's expression.
Yeah, I mean, other than the actual art, I'm talking about the quality of the ink. The way, you know, what are we looking for when we're looking for, like, when we can say that's a good tattoo?
It's funny you should say that because it's hard to tell nowadays, because nowadays it's like, it's almost like stylish or trendy to be messy. You know, when I was coming up in the tattoo world, lines has to be crisp, right? Colors have to be vibrant. Shading has to be smooth. Everything had to be on almost like a graphic level. You know what I'm saying? Like when you're doing something like a graphic art, you know, like everything has to be perfect. You know, everything has to be in its place. And now it's a little bit more free form. So you see a lot of messy stuff. So sometimes you can't tell unless you're a tattoo artist, you know, because sometimes it's just an expression. Like there's this thing that's called, I forgot what it's called, like it's the new tribal, I guess, where it's like super messy and thorny and kind of just inks everywhere, right? And that is a trendy thing, you know, and that's, there's people who get paid big money to do that, kind of stuff, right? So now you'd have to, with a trained eye, you can tell, you know, what's good and what's not. But right away, you see the lines are crooked, of course, you know, it's a bad tattoo, right? Or the color's fading. Sometimes even like the lines are blown out, which means like they get fuzzy, you know, by when a tattoo artist goes too deep or something like that, and it breaks a blood vessel and then breaks through like the third barrier, the skin, barrier of skin. And then so the ink blows out underneath and stuff like that. So that's one way you can tell too.
Have you ever done bad tattoos before?
Oh, I didn't get here by doing good tattoos my whole life. You know what I mean? You have to break a few eggs if you're going to make a cake.
But what happens when you see those tattoos? You know,
gotta play it off, bro. You gotta play it off, man. Like, oh my god, great! You gotta
know.
You're not gonna let them know that you fucked up. You know what I mean? And I have fucked up. You know, and just little stuff here and there. A lot of it more to do with I could have done this a little bit better. You know?
Okay.
In retrospect, I'll be like, oh man, I should have shaded it this way. I should have shaded it that way. I'm beyond the part of fucking up. Whereas like, oh, I fucking put an extra E on a fucking letter, on a word, or, you know, spell the name wrong. I've done that a couple times in my life, as a matter of fact. So I'm not immune to fuck ups like that, you know, but, you know, so I'm at the point where it's not about fucking up. It's more about Chris being your own worst critic, you know, like, hey, man, looking back, I'm like, man, I should have shaded that a little darker. I should have eased up on that a little bit. I shouldn't have added on that extra thing here and there. I get that every day. I do that to myself every day because my projects are so big. I'll do a whole sleeve and it'll take me like a whole half a year to a year, you know, because, you know, of course, I only work like 4 hours at a day at a time now. So by the time I'm finished with the sleeve, it'll be a year already, you know. And me critiquing myself, like after every appointment, by the time I'm finished with that sleeve, I'm so over that sleeve that I'm like, not that I'm not proud of it. I'm just like, man, you know, it's just that self-criticism. That's like, you could have done a lot better. You know, you could have, you know. I mean, I still look at it through fresh eyes, of course, like, okay. I mean, it's a good tattoo, but at me, myself, I'm like, man, I don't want to take a picture of that. So that's why I don't take pictures of my work a lot anymore. And I think is, man, my freaking client's going to hate me for saying this. But sometimes when I'm finished with that piece, I'm so overlooking at that piece. I just want to,
oh, but that makes like, sense.
Yeah, like let's move on to the next piece if you let me. You know what I mean? And not that I'm not proud of it. It's I'm not proud of myself. You know, because looking back, I could have done a lot better, you know, now in you know, this time. You know, but at that time I did the best I could, you know.
But Bob, that's what makes, I think, a good human being, a good artist, is when you can say to something that it could have been better, and you're always scrutinizing your work. I think that's like the mark of somebody who really cares about what they do. Because a lot of times, maybe I can look at something and I'm like, damn, I'm so proud of that, you know? And then really, if you don't take the time to articulate what you could have done better at every intersection, then your work doesn't improve, it doesn't advance. So I think that maybe perhaps that's built into the culture of any artist, is kind of like that introspection.
Yeah. And I think if you talk to any tattoo artist,
they'll probably
say the same thing. It's just nobody brought that out of them. You know what I mean? Nobody had sat down and say, hey, you know, like what you're doing, you know, with me right now, you know, you're kind of like bringing that out of me. But I guarantee you most artists would, 99% of artists, tattoo artists would say that too. You know, like, yeah, they could say that they're proud of that work, but a little bit of them would say, man, I could have done that a little different, or a little bit better. That's a guarantee.
Yeah. And I think even probably singers, when they look back at the tape, like on different performances,
right?
They feel the same way. Like, damn, yeah. I sung that note differently.
Yeah.
Like everybody who's, you know, who cares enough about what they do.
Yeah. It's creativity. It's a human nature of creativity. You know, you're always there's a reason why you progress, you know, and it's just a natural progression of an artist is to make things better. You know, that's why when you see like a lot of artwork, like a lot of tattoo art, and I noticed this, and a lot of people notice this too, like somebody can always like create something really nice and they'll post it, right? On, you know, IG or whatever. And then you'll see later on something similar to that done a lot better, right? It's because somebody had to start out with, you know, that vision first.
Yeah.
So it's so much easier to fix, you know, what's already there
and
or improve on what's there already there. Yeah. So again, touching back on like original Vietnamese artwork is like, where do we find original Vietnamese artwork? You know what I mean? It's always created from an influence of somewhere, and then people kind of build on it.
That's like, the thing about Vietnamese culture as well. If you go back like 1,000 years, you will go, what is Vietnamese culture? You know, it gets really tricky, these answers, but then a lot of these things are cobbled together.
No, we're relatively a young, I guess a young culture, right? Not like the Japanese and Koreans and Indians.
Exactly.
Or Chinese. That's like deep there. Yeah, they're so deep rooted, right? Like, so when you see Indian art, you know that's Indian art. You see Chinese art, you know that's Chinese art. And it originated from them. Japanese art for sure, right? There's no like arguing, oh, you know, that's not Japanese art, right? So with Vietnamese art, we're just so influenced by other culture because we're a relatively young culture, I think, you know, that we don't really. And I think a lot too, just from what I know about our history, is we were more like into agricultural and struggling and working and defending ourselves. The government didn't really promote art. You know, we didn't have the time to sit down and, you know, paint these murals on wonderful temples. You get what I'm saying? Nobody commissioned anybody to do stuff like that. We just did what was necessary, which is agriculture, milk, making rice paddies, and, you know, and just defending our land and stuff like that. So we didn't have time, the luxury, to be artistic.
Yeah, it's complicated.
It is complicated. Like, I can't look back and go, let me see, what is a wonderful artist, Vietnamese artist back in like the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s? You can't, right? And you, but in like in the Western culture, yeah, is, you know, Da Vinci,
a shit ton of them.
Yeah, a shit ton.
Yeah. But you know, there are Vietnamese painters, fine artists that came out of Vietnam that were brought up by the French.
Yeah.
So in the 1800s,
Western influence.
They had schools of art schools in Hanoi that produced artists that were, you know, trained by European schools in Vietnam. And wow. And the history of that exists. And it's a very strange sort of part of our history. There's an art historian in Paris that he's a quarter Vietnamese, and he studied, you know, that time period. And I had him on the podcast, and he talked about the sliver of that history, but it doesn't feel like it's, it doesn't feel like what you would imagine maybe Vietnamese art to be, right? It's when you're European trained, there's techniques and there's different ways of perspective that you mm-hmm. see. And yeah, and it's part
and it of it shows, right?
And it shows, yeah, it's part of our legacy. But mm-hmm. you know, it's Vietnamese history is so complicated. We can get into it forever. Have you ever been back to Vietnam?
As a matter of fact, I was back there in 2017. I hadn't gone back since I left, which was like, so I didn't set back foot back to the mother country in 35 years or something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but no, 37 years, 38 years almost. Left in 79. So yeah. So and it was a trip.
Do you ever work with any Vietnamese tattoo artists? Do you know anything about the Vietnamese tattoo scene?
Not really. I mean, I follow a couple of guys out there. It's a couple of guys are really good. Mm-hmm. One of them is Lam Viet, right? He's phenomenal. He does great Japanese work. And there's another fella who does great color portrait. His name escapes me, but when I was there, I didn't see a big tattoo culture. And from what I hear now, it's booming. You know? And yeah. Well, when I was there, I saw a few people that had tattoos, but, and then mostly the tattoos that I've seen that were like extensive or like sleeves and stuff like that were on Big Q, which were tourists, you know, Vietnamese tourists like myself.
Yep.
So I didn't see that big surge or boom. I didn't know anything about that. And then I just recently, you know, I was introduced to it through Andy. Andy was telling me about it, that culture, and how we're just blowing up over there. And
huge.
Yeah, huge, huge. And I would love to go back there again soon and just kind of like visit all these tattoo shops and see how they do business and stuff, you know.
I see regular housewives with tattoos all the time in Vietnam.
Really?
Market. Wow. Yeah, you go to the market, you see just regular housewives with tattoos. And it's just like, it's a normal thing. Nobody's thinking anything like gangs or street life or anything. It's just pure art for people in Vietnam.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
see like these nerdy guys all tatted up. It's phenomenal. Yep. Like just to see the...
When was the last time you were there?
2-3 weeks ago.
Wow. Okay. So very recent. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I was there in January and then back in May.
Nice. Nice. Yeah. Nice. Yeah. So I think that's great. I think it's great. I think that, you know, it's time like our people, you know, had that part to explore, you know, whereas before we were just, you know, so close-minded. I think with, you know, like with Instagram and other social media, you know, we're more exposed. So our people are like, you know, coming up in the world, man.
I can't imagine what you were going through with all the elders as you were coming up as a tattoo artist. It was frowned upon 25, 30 years ago. Like, even
man, you should see, years ago. You should see my mom's face when I told her, you know, I'm quitting my job and I'm going to be a tattoo artist.
How did she
full time?
How has she felt throughout the years? How has it changed?
It hasn't changed. She still doesn't get it to this day. She's like, isn't that enough tattoo you're getting? I mean, you already own a shop. Why are you still getting tattooed? How much cooler do you want to look? You know, my wounds are gone, my sao, my ass out.
But let me ask you this though: are those terms of endearment at this point, or is it really that you think she means it?
No, she's still old school, and she still like frowns upon me getting tattooed. The only tattoo she ever liked was the one on my neck, which has her and my dad's name. And that's the only one that she likes. And I remember showing her that. And this is like back in, so say 96. So I started tattooing in 95, right? So when I got my neck tattoo, it was kind of symbolic for myself as like no turning back symbol, you know what I mean? Because back then, nobody really got tattoos on their neck, much less Vietnamese, unless you're like, you know, straight out of the joint or that's a long stretch of time or whatever, where you just fuck the world, I don't give a fuck no more. You know, I'm a criminal. That's all there is to it. And I'm going to get a tattoo on my neck. But for me, it was more of a like a self-proclamation of in it to win it, all in.
Wow.
Pot committed. I'm going for it. I'm doing it. You can't fucking get a normal job now, because you cannot get a normal job. I don't care. You know, if you can't even get a warehouse job back in the 90s with a neck tattoo. You know what I'm saying? Whereas now you can get a job at fucking Walmart, you know, greeting people.
Yeah.
Right. So when I first got the neck tattoo, that was, you know, very significant for me. And so I had to get something that was really important. And that was my mom and dad's name. You know, so when I came home, and mind you, I had extensive work done already at the time, but that was kind of like a deal sealer. So I came home and I had this bandage on my neck still. And God, man, the look on her face, just the disappointment. I walk in the door, and this time I was still living at home because, you know, my daughter is like 3 years old. I'm a single parent. I needed the help. And I needed, you know, the guidance of parental guidance to help me raise my daughter. So I was still living at home. I was driving up from Hollywood back to Orange County every day. And I came home with this bandage on my neck.
Damn.
Walk into the kitchen. I knew what I was walking into, you know. She was cooking something, I still remember. And she just dropped her spoon into the pot. She's like, oh. And, you know, in Vietnamese, she's like, trời, đất ơi, mày nữa rồi. Mày hại tao hoài vậy. So I'm không giết tao cho nó lẹ đi. Which in English sounds not as bad, but still pretty bad. Like, why don't you just kill me, make it quicker? You know what I mean? Why do you keep hurting me? You know? And I say, just wait, mom. You know, in Vietnamese, like, mẹ chờ đi, okay? Chờ chung rửa, chờ chung mẹ coi. So just wait, mom. Let me show you what it is. Say, hi, I don't care, nữa. You know, I took off my bandage, washed off my neck, and I turned on the light. And I went over her. You know, she's like 5 foot nothing. You know, she's looking up at me in the kitchen with the light on my neck. She just looked at me and sighs, and looks at me and goes, "Oh, no, you do that, huh?" And then walks off, which means she's saying, "Well, at least the writing is nice," and then just walks off. I mean, so by that, I knew that at least she liked that one, you know, because she recognized that was my dad and her name, you know. But yeah, so tattoos, in other words, every tattoo has significance to me. You know, I know exactly what my mindset was and my mind state and at what stage in my life I was at when I got those tattoo or that particular tattoo or whichever particular tattoo I had. And there's always a story, a memory behind it, you know? So I guess that's why a tattoo means a lot to me, you know, getting tattoos too.
It's been quite the opposite for me. And I'm glad you brought that up, because for me, it's always been a shame in the last 30 years. I mean, I think my first tattoo was when I was 17, and I'm 48 now. And I think when I look back on where I was, there was so much shame in who I was. So then I got the tattoo of Vietnam, the word on me, and my last name, because I like I'm gonna forget my last name.
I have it on my stomach too.
Right, but that was like the mindset of the 90s, and it's like, you know, a lot of that sort of I think comes from either prison culture or gang culture.
Yeah,
at the time. That's what we were all doing.
It's yeah, a lot of pride, a lot of pride, a lot of, misguided pride.
Misguided pride. I mean, pride for no reason, pride.
Yeah. so like having the hardest Vietnamese name to pronounce, you know, Nguyen, and then getting tattoo on you too. Yeah.
And then I go to Vietnam and the other kids are like, oh, make a Yoda, right?
Wing.
It is so embarrassing, you know, and I'm like, oh, I got to come down to you guys to get this touched up.
No way, bro. Be proud of that. That's your history.
That's hard part for me to reconcile that. It's very cringy for me to think about what I was thinking about when I was 17 and the tattoos that I asked to get put on my body are just like, they're just cringy, you know?
I think what you should do is embrace it and know that, you know, that there was that part.
Yeah,
time in your life that kid was getting those tattoos and then realize where you are now, right? So it kind of shows that, you know, we all have it in us to be better, to progress, you know what I mean, to I guess evolve, you know. So embrace it, man. I embrace all my stuff, you know. Yeah, I have a lot of stuff that I covered up, mostly gang stuff, but stuff like that I don't want my kids to see, you know what I mean. But for the most part, yeah, I'm proud of my tattoos, man. Even the crappy ones.
Oh, Bob, it was so wonderful to talk to you today. And, you know, refreshing to hear how open and honest you are about the profession.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. It's been a while. I've been listening to you, too. So, yeah, a friend of mine, well, client of mine, Chris, you know, Chris Burton.
Yeah.
She turned me on to you, and I started listening to you, and I was like, man, this guy's good. He's a good interviewer.
Oh, you know? Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah, Chris over at La Quinta High, wonderful. Speaking of which, I mean, Chris Burton is a force to be reckoned with over at La Quinta. Oh,
she, for sure. She actually, so not only she's a client, but she kind of is a big, like, proponent of the Vietnamese culture and bringing the culture together, bring people together.
Absolutely.
To promote our culture. And I think that's wonderful. She has no like veil, you know what I mean? She doesn't see anybody through a veil. She brought me into the high school to participate in these activities and to sponsor the kids, and which I love. I love the kids over there.
And she's all tatted up, and you know,
that's
cool.
I think that's great. I think awesome. Like what you guys, like you in particular, and her, and that's the type of people that, you know, that you bring together. I think it's awesome. I think it's awesome for our culture and our community. You know, and it's long overdue.
Thank you.
So I it's an honor for me to be on this podcast. It's an honor for me to like speak to whoever wants to listen. You know, and you know, go get a tattoo, man. It'll change your life.
Before we go, though, it's awesome that you brought up Chris Burton, because I want to talk about this really cool thing before we end the episode. You and I, this year for Tet, we were invited to be sort of these dignitaries at La Quinta. It was fun. It was great. And it was awesome because we all showed up in our aoyai.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting with you and Chris Tran from Little Saigon Official. We were sitting there in a row, the three of us.
Yeah.
Talking about something super cool. And I actually tell this story to a lot of people. That I was talking to Bob from Bad Influence Tattoo, and we were talking about this idea of aoyai, and you said this, I'll never forget it. You said that you have an idea that you want to put a rack inside of your store and put up all the used aoyais that you have, because you know, you don't wear it twice to big events.
So
put up this used rack with 15 or 20 of your used aoyais, and then we can all come in and switch them out to rotate these aoyais. And I thought, oh my God, this is so genius.
Yeah. And cool. So that's what I'm going to do next year. Probably like in the beginning of the year, I'm going to start promoting that, because I see that just And again, a lot of it has to do with wastefulness too. You know, I myself, I'm guilty of that. I buy a new Aoyai every year. But what I do with my Aoyai is my old one that I wear from last year, I'll find somebody that has never worn one before, and I'll really get into them with it. Like, hey, promote our culture. You got to wear it. Hey, you know what? You're about my size. And I usually pick guys about my size, and I really promote it with them, and I give it to them. And for me, it's almost like, you know, promoting our culture at the same time, recycling that material.
Absolutely. You know?
And it gives me a chance to get a new Aoyai because I'm new. I'm new like that. I got to get a new Aoyai every year.
And I love that. When I heard that, I was like, man, this is a real cool idea that I think a lot of us, I think me, you, and Chris Tran, we should promote that when a few weeks before that this next year. Yeah. Come down to your shop and
I'm gonna put one in there. I'm gonna tell people, hey, if you have an Aoyai, you want to trade come out, by. Switch out, bring them out. Or if you don't have an Aoyai and you want just a free Aoyai, come down and get a free Aoyai.
Wow, man.
You know, and a lot of guys like us were like, yeah, we don't mind buying another Aoyai. It's like $40, bro. Come on, right? So I don't mind just putting it on the rack and letting dude that never wore an Aoyai. Be more an incentive for him to try out the Aoyai if he doesn't have to pay for it. Just come out wear and promote our culture.
And a lot of people, a lot of men are not wearing Aoyai, and I think you and I talked about that. Like Chris Tran didn't wear Aoyais before, and now
I think it's awesome. I think I just started wearing Aoyai maybe about four or five years ago. I started wearing Aoyai, and I think it's awesome, and I think that we should be known more. I mean, for the amount of decades that we've been here, we should be no more for our culture other than pho, right?
Yep.
Or bansai or whatever.
We should be known just for our fucking Aoyai alone.
That's why, you know what I'm saying? It's fucking cool, man. It looks cool.
It's cool as hell.
It looks like you're in the mafia, but you're not in the mafia. You know what I mean?
Cool as hell. And I think when you wear one where it's like it's like a really badass one, especially the custom ones,
you
feel this sense of power. And here's another lazy side of it though. You ain't gotta like look for the tie. You don't have to look this is one thing. Just put that
boom. Over. Get back in the car, take it off, throw it on the rack, you know, get out of the car, put it back on. Like four buttons, bro. Come on.
Yeah, you know it's like a superhero outfit. You know, that's how I feel in it.
Yeah, man, it's awesome. It's great. Thank gosh, it doesn't look goofy. You know what I mean? I don't think it looks goofy. I think it looks really slick. You know what I mean? So thank God that our forefather, our ancestors said, let's just make it not look goofy. You know what I mean? And so they made something kind of cool.
Very cool.
Cool. Yeah, hoping to see you at the next Aoyai.
We'll do it a few weeks before Ted come down to your shop, and then we'll shoot the shit. Maybe have Chris turn on the cameras, and then we can
I would love that. That's something awesome. Another thing, I was just remembering when we're at the La Quinta, and we're sitting in like the second row or something like that, which is like almost the front row.
Yeah.
And I remember us goofing around and making like these weird, these like perverted gestures and stuff like that, like pretty much like frat boy gestures. And then I turn around and there's the mayor, all these official heads looking at us, and we're just like acting like a couple of teenage boys, man. I thought that was so funny.
But I think we need to keep it that way, man. To be honest, as long as it's not offensive, I think having that youthful spirit, because I don't want to look like. To be honest with you, my father was a goofball to the day he died. So
nice.
I don't want to be like those 80-year-old guys in whatever culture. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be like, I want to be remembered as like that 80-year-old guy who's like still 18 years old, just still a goofball.
Yeah.
You know?
And I think that's what keeps you young. You're young at heart, so.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to be, I want to be like Mike. I want my kids to be like dad, like grow up dad. You know, that. You know, because if you can come with a lot of experience, a lot of knowledge, a lot of stories, but then act still young, I think that's, for me, that's balance.
Yeah. That's the fun of life, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Bob, I hope to see you again very soon. And
yeah, brother.
Yeah, thanks for spending this time with me today.
All right. Thanks a lot, buddy. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.